out of the anti-white system and tune in to the pro-white system at radioarian.com.
And welcome to the Daily Nationalist. Today's date is Friday, the 2nd of March, 2018. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, and I am joined today by Florian Geyer from Mysterium Fasces. Florian, how are you doing today?
I'm doing just fantastic, Sven. It's a pleasure to be back on.
Yeah, it's good to be speaking to you once again. I think we've got an interesting podcast for listeners today. We've got a news story to begin with, and then we're going to look at the Jewish festival of Purim and the Book of Esther, because the Jews have been celebrating Purim this week. But first off, we've got a news story that's just happened, just as we're recording this, and it's basically the latest attempt to portray nationalists as terrorists. A man has been convicted of attempting to murder a Muslim woman and a 12-year-old schoolgirl in revenge for Islamist terror attacks. Paul Moore, 21, told relatives he was doing the country a favour after ramming his car into the victims in Leicester on the 20th of September, 5 days after the Parsons Green Tube bombing. Zainab Hussain, who is Somali and wears a headscarf, was walking down Asa Close after dropping her children off at school when Moore hit her with his Volkswagen. He showed no emotion as a jury found him guilty of attempted murder, grievous bodily harm with intent, and dangerous driving on Friday. The court previously heard that the defendant launched the attack as revenge for the London 7/7 bombings and the Parsons Green terror attack, which was claimed by ISIS. Prosecutors said Moore targeted Miss Hussain purely because of the colour of her skin and her perceived Islamic faith. So once again, this is just being put down to hatred of the colour of skin, nothing to do with the attacks that have been going on, the terrorist attacks that Muslims have been carrying out in Britain. I mean, that's what directly led to this. He said that he was doing this as revenge, almost in defence and doing the country a favour. And he's being punished for this. He's been told this is a hate crime. It's aggravated charges. They haven't actually released the prison sentence yet. But in the same week, we've had Jews celebrating the slaughter of thousands of goyim and innocent goyim as well, if you believe one of the stories, because we're going to look. There's actually three different versions of Esther that Purim is based upon. But the one that the Jews are celebrating is the wholesale slaughter of undefended women, children, and whoever they felt like killing. Thousands of them. And they've been celebrating this week on Purim. And yet here we have this white man that says that he did the same thing. And he's being attacked for it, and he's going to go to jail. And it's not seen as, what is the word, extenuating circumstances, I think it is. It's not seen as extenuating circumstances that the country had just been the victim of a terrorist attack. I mean, really, that should be held into account as having influenced his actions here, because he believed he was defending the country, but it's not. It's going to actually stand against him. He's actually going to be punished more for this, not punished less. What are your views on this, Florian, before we move into Purim and Esther?
Well, I think that's exactly correct. That is what the state is going to do, is they're going to make an example of him. I mean, the British government has really been stepping up its active persecution of right-wing dissidents, but not even right-wing dissidents, anybody who is vaguely conservative and doesn't like the racial replacement that's going on in the United Kingdom, the total dissolution and destruction of the native British people's culture and societies at the hands of mass immigration and the cultural economic system. And so, I mean, it's exactly correct that this, so what do people expect is going to happen? when you destroy society, when you atomize individuals from one another, when you introduce mass social agony and tension, you inflict trauma on a soft level to the large portions of your population. This is the kind of response that you get. You know, and so when people, look at and they see, Muslims engaging in the mass grooming and rape of girls like we saw in Rotherham or any of the terrorist attacks, well, this is a natural target for, right, appropriately, their resentment and their anger. I mean, and so it's not a very complicated situation. I think anybody can understand why this kind of stuff occurs, why this man did what he did, because he's reacting to the circumstances around him. And so the system knows this. The system knows that this is the kind of thing that will occur when they introduce these kind of environments. They know that people will lash out, and the whole purpose is when that occurs, you take that man and you demonize him, because then it can be used as a propaganda instrument in order to dull the national feeling, the national consciousness in the home population, because people, they don't want to be, you don't like Muslims in your country. You don't like girls being raped en masse. Oh, you must be like this, right-wing terrorist. You must be National Action supporter. You must be XYZ. And it's approaching the point where, even if that is the case, you could be subject to criminal sanction just for expressing these views openly. It's just the level of censorship in the United Kingdom. There are, youths being held right now, our friends, under terrorism charges for nothing, for allegedly posting some anti-invasion stickers. That's it, right? And so the, extenuating circumstances, well, the government doesn't need any evidence. It's not an evidence-based. It's not even moral-based. It's just a system of cultural repression, essentially. That's what it's all about, is to keep the host population in check by use of fear of being dragged through the courts and so on. And so whether that's in instances of activists who are totally innocent, or whether that's, guys who basically snap, right, and do this kind of, violence, it doesn't matter to them. They create the problem, and then they crack down on people who want a solution.
Right or wrong. Logically, they should be lenient on them because of the extenuating circumstances. Terrorist attacks, logically, they should be lenient on them, but they're not. They want to make an example of them. And as I say, if we look back in the past, in history, any time there was a fear of being attacked by people, it was self-defense. You attacked back, and this is what the Jews have been celebrating with Purim. I mean, Purim took place on February the 28th, a couple of days ago, and it's a Jewish festival. It's not ordained by God in the Old Testament, because in the Old Testament, God says what festivals the Israelites are supposed to follow. And this new festival of Purim that the modern Jews celebrate, it's celebrating the slaughter of thousands of undefended Goyim. Now, it's based on the Book of Esther, and Esther is quite a strange book. There are actually three different versions of it, and it was not included in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the Dead Sea Scrolls have every other book from the Old Testament in them. And the basic story of Esther, I guess, do you want to say the basic story of Esther, Florin, or do you want me to explain that?
Sure, we can go through it really quick. The basic story of Esther is that there are certain Jews who are in exile in Persia, and there's a certain king who convenes a great feast. And so the king orders the queen to display her beauty before the guests by wearing her only crown. And when she refuses, he removes her from her position. And essentially, the long story short is that he's selecting some new beautiful young women throughout the empire to be his new queen. Among these women is the Jewish orphan Esther, who is fostered by her uncle Mordecai. So she finds favor, becomes the new queen. And shortly after, Mordecai discovers a plot to assassinate the king. And long story short, this king appoints a certain viceroy by the name of Haman. And now Mordecai, the foster father of this this young Esther, becomes an enemy of Haman because he refuses to bow down to him. And so it's alleged that Haman discovers Mordecai discovers that Haman wants to kill all the Jews in Persia. And he obtains permission to execute this plan. And so the idea is that one night the king couldn't sleep, and he orders the court records be read to him. And he's reminded that Mordecai at one point foiled a plot against his life from other of his courtiers. Just then the Haman appears, he requests the king's permission to hang Mordecai, etc. Before he can make the request, the king asks Haman what should be done for him if the king wishes to honor him. Haman suggests that the man be dressed in the king's royal robes and led around on the king's royal horse, and the Herod honored him and so on. To his surprise and horror, the king instructs Haman to do so. Immediately after, the king and Haman attend Esther's second banquet. The king promises to grant her any request, and she reveals that she's Jewish and that Haman is planning to exterminate her people, including her. Overcome by rage, the king leaves the room. Meanwhile, Haman stays behind and begs Esther for his life, falling upon her in desperation. The king returns at this very moment and thinks Haman is assaulting the queen, which makes him angrier, and he orders Haman hanged on the royal gallows. And so unable to annul a formal royal decree, the king adds to it, permitting the Jews to arm and defend themselves on the day chosen for their annihilation. And so allegedly there are different stories of this particular detail, which is the core detail of the plot, as to whether or not the Jews were allowed to kill people who were aggressing against them or anybody. And so what the Talmudists, the Pharisees, alleges that the king gave them permission to kill anybody, and that they killed 75,000 Persians in revenge for the attempt to destroy the Judeans in exile in Persia. So that's the short story of it. I'm sorry for my rather long and bumbling recount. No, so the essence of the festival is the recollection from the Jewish perspective of the slaughter of 75,000 essentially innocent Persians for the most part.
Yeah, it is. That's a good summing up of the story. I think that's got all the basic parts to it. And these three different versions, they really do differ quite a lot from one another. I mean, even the version from the Septuagint and the version that's in the King James Bible are very, very different. I mean, I haven't actually read the Septuagint version. I've read the version by Flavius Josephus where he summarizes it. And both stories they couldn't be more different, to be honest. In the Bible version, the King James version, there's no mention of God in the entire book. And it's the only book in the Bible not to mention God. And I always thought, well, maybe this book shouldn't actually be there. What is this book about? And when you read the book, it reads like a warning against the Jews. It shows the Jews breaking God's laws. It shows them encouraging converts, something which is not recorded happening elsewhere until much later after their return to Judea. As I say, it doesn't mention God in it. At the end of it, the king institutes taxes on everyone. Again, you know, that says it's very Jewish. It mentions the word Jew in it as well. It doesn't talk about Israelites or Judah or anything like that. And Esther behaves just like you would imagine a Jew to behave. So it seems to me to be a warning about the Jews. And there's one particular verse in it. In Esther 3, verse 8, and it says, "And Haman said unto King Ahasuerus," who is King Artaxerxes, "There is a certain people scattered abroad and dispersed among the people in all the provinces of thy kingdom, and their laws are diverse from all people, neither keep they the king's laws. Therefore it is not for the king's profit to suffer them." And that's where he's trying to get the king to kill all the Jews. And when this reminded me of another verse in the New Testament, in 1 Thessalonians 2:15, and you've got Paul speaking here, and he says, "The Jews, who both killed the Lord Jesus and their own prophets, and have persecuted us, and they please not God, and are contrary to all men." And where he says, "and they are contrary to all men," that's the same as Mordecai or Haman saying, "their laws are diverse from all people." And here is Paul saying they are contrary to all men. So it seems very much like the version in the King James Bible is talking about the Jews, the predecessors to today's modern Jews. And Mordecai, he refuses to worship Haman as a god. And this was a bone of contention much later on with Rome, and certain Judeans refused to worship Caesar as a god, and that caused all sorts of problems. And the Bible version, or the King James Bible version, says that Haman fell asleep on Esther's bed. And that sounds very likely as if she was a Jew and he was trying to seduce her, or she was trying to seduce him. Obviously very, very dodgy. But the Josephus version says that he was just pleading with her on the couch when the king came in. He wasn't asleep on her bed. And the King James version says that the king said that the Jews could slay anyone they felt like, women, little ones, whoever. The actual verse says, to slay and to cause to perish all the people, all the power of the people and province that would assault them, both little ones and women, and to take the spoil of them for a prey. So he's saying to take all their possessions, take all their booty as well. But the Josephus version has the king telling Esther that her ethnic nation may defend themselves on that day against any who attack them, and they do, but they do not take any of the possessions of those that they have killed. And all they were able to do was to defend themselves, because the king couldn't rescind his decree. And the Bible says, thus the Jews smote all their enemies with the stroke of the sword and slaughter and destruction, and did what they would unto those that hated them. So it makes it quite clear that they just went on a slaughtering rampage, and they were given an extra day to do more of it as well. And it lists how many people they killed. And it says, and many of the people of the land became Jews, for the fear of the Jews fell upon them. And again, this is like the modern Jews. It seems to me that the King James Bible is warning the Christian reader of what the Jews are like. And they certainly shouldn't have been converting people and bringing them in and saying, oh, yes, you too can be Jews. You can take part in these covenants, because that wasn't part of the promises. They weren't supposed to be converting people. That was something that happened later on. And as I say, finally, you get Artaxerxes lays a tax on the land. For me, that's the final identifier. Yes, this is the Jews that it's talking about. They then convince the king to lay a tax on the land. But the Septuagint version, the version that Josephus is talking about, is quite different. And in the Talmud version, it is different again. And we've also got these Achaemenid kings, King Artaxerxes, who was an Achaemenid king, which meant that he was descended from Shem. So it was quite lawful for Esther to marry the king if she was indeed an orphan from the tribe of Benjamin. But as I say, the Talmud is completely different. And I've got a quote here from Michael Hoffman talking about the Talmud. He says, the rabbis chose to add to Esther significantly, as is their custom with regards to the books of the Hebrew Bible. According to their midrash on Esther, she was married to Mordecai. That's supposedly her father, according to the Bible. Not only was Esther an upright Jewish woman who had bored the notion of marriage to the goy king Ahasuerus, she was actually already married to Mordecai, who was the greatest sage, that's master of the oral law, of his generation. Every time Esther went to Ahasuerus, she was literally taken and forced to be with him. Throughout her marriage to Ahasuerus, Esther still remained loyal to her true husband Mordecai. After leaving Ahasuerus' presence, she would immerse in a mikvah, or ritual bath, and then secretly rendezvous with Mordecai. And the preceding convoluted fabrication is typical of the Talmudic perversion of the biblical narrative. The Megillah states that Mordecai took Esther as a bat, or a daughter, and the rabbis claim that bat actually means bayit, or home, a euphemism for wife. And similar absurd wordplay in the Babylonian Talmud is used to prove that the mother of David's opponent, the giant Goliath, was addicted to anal sex. And this is really typical of the Talmud. On Purim, it is necessary for the Judaic male to get drunk. He is to become so completely drunk that he cannot discern good from evil, no longer distinguishing between Haman, cursed is Haman, and Baruch Mordecai, blessed is Mordecai. And one of the foods served on the holiday of Purim are Haman's ears, which are a pair of ears baked from pastry. So this really degenerate festival that they have is based on them slaughtering lots of people. And the book in the King James Version sort of says that you know, this is what these Jews are like. They've become corrupted by this time. And then the Talmud perverts it even more and says that she was married to Mordecai. Whereas the version that was actually around at Jesus' time, the one that Flavius Josephus uses, which is the Septuagint version, is quite different. And, you know, it's well, it couldn't be more different from what I can see it. What do you think of it?
Well, it even includes prayers to God. I mean, there's no reference of God at all in the Hebraic translation, the later translation, which students of biblical history will know that after the destruction of the Second Temple, the rabbis decided to eliminate any of the Greek translations of the text. It's the Septuagint version, the LXX version, famously translated in the city of Alexandria for King Ptolemy I, which was the version that Christ used and all of the early church fathers used. And so, for instance, in that version, Book of Esther, we have quite a few prayers of God to God, actually. Mordecai, when upon hearing of Haman's plot to kill the Jews, he prays fervently to Christ. There's a big prayer. O Lord, our Lord, King who rulest over all things, for the universe is in thy power, and there is no one who can oppose thee if it is thy will to save Israel, etc., etc. You know, and even, like, it goes back to even the response. The response in this book is that the Jews are allowed to defend themselves, and they're specifically not allowed to take any property, and that God enables them to perfectly defend themselves because they turn to him to save them, which is a totally different story completely than what the rabbis present. And Esther in this story is, you know, like a model of fidelity both to her husband and her people, right? Which is what we see set out in like the books of the other prophets who are in exile in Babylon, who are like the prophet Daniel, who, you know, works for the common good of the entire kingdom of Babylon, but also places God's law higher than that of the earthly law. And so it's a radical distinction here. But for the Jews, for the Pharisees specifically, for the proto-Talmudists and their later codification of their oral law, it's one and the same. That God's law is their ethnic law. It's the service to their blood lineage and the administration of God's law and the rabbinic opinion. These are all the same concept.
That's the laughable thing, I think. I mean, they talk about, you know, their bloodline and they mustn't outmarry from the Jews. And yet here we go. Here we've got this book in the King James Old Testament that says that everybody else became Jews and became converted. All these people that supposedly, you know, they weren't allowed to have become a part of them, if you see what I mean. You know, it's you know, it's just none of it adds up. What, you know, what the Jews tell us is all a pack of lies. And if we go back to this, you know, we see that in the original version, this old version, the Septuagint version that Flavius Josephus uses, Esther is a really virtuous woman. She's a virgin when she meets the king, and lawfully she is allowed to marry him because he was of the line of Shem. So that's a big difference from what you get in this Talmudist version, which says that, oh, actually, she was married to Mordecai. The king was Goyim, so he wasn't, you know, he was just a beast. He was no better than the beasts. And people that go along with this, that go along with this Purim festival and think, oh, yes, this is the Jews celebrating Esther, this great woman from the Bible. You know, it's a pack of lies. There's even been Jews dressing up as the Twin Towers that the planes went into on 9/11 on Purim. And they get as drunk as they can. You often see the pictures of the Jewish kids smoking cigars and getting drunk. And the whole point of their holiday here is just to get absolutely wrecked and celebrate killing Gentiles. And yet the moral of the story in Josephus 1 is that what goes around comes around. There's this Haman builds a 50-foot crucifix that he wants to put Mordecai on, and Haman himself ends up being put on the 50-foot crucifix. And it tells you that Mordecai was really loyal to the king, and he told the king about this plot that the courtiers were having to murder him. And the king says, do you want any reward? And he says, no, just put it in the records that a man of my ethnicity foiled this plot for you. So he would rather that his nation was thought of in a better way than actually being given any physical rewards. It's completely the opposite. So this is the strange thing. So we've got two versions. In one of them, we've got the Judeans in the captivity behaving like proper Israelites, and in the other version, we've got Jews in captivity behaving exactly the same as we see Jews behaving today. And yet one version is the Septuagint and one version is in the King James Bible. And I think this is the reason why it was excluded from the Dead Sea Scrolls. You know, as we were mentioning earlier, that the Dead Sea Scrolls contain every book from the Old Testament, but this one. And I think it's because Esther seems to be a romance story, and it's been embellished by both the Jews, that's the proto-Talmudists, the proselytes of the gate, the proselytes of justice, the Pharisees, all these mixed Judean groups that were around at the time, and genuine Hebrew tradition, which is what comes out in the Flavius Josephus version and in the Septuagint version. And therefore, the Essenes did not include it in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And the story has a different moral for each group. With Josephus, it is a faith of the ages, that those who live by the sword will die by the sword. With the Bible version, or King James Bible version, it is a warning about what the Jews had become once they were known as Jews and were multicultural. And the Talmud version is the usual filth and slanders that you expect from them about the biblical characters. And to be honest, I mean, for quite a while, I just thought that this whole story was a warning against the Jews. And that's why it was in the King James version. But then after reading the Josephus version, you know, I'm inclined to think, well, you know, that gives a moral to it. That's much better. But from looking at all of them, you know, it says to me that this is a romance story, and that there are various embellishments that have been put upon it. So you can take it with a different moral from whichever person it is that's actually writing it. It's very different to the other books of the Bible, and it often gets used against Christians by nationalists as well. They will say, well, what about Esther? How can you support Esther? So if people say that, then you can point out that the version that's in the King James Bible warns against the Jews, and the version that's in the Septuagint actually, you know, doesn't contain the same traditions about killing, just massacring men, women and undefended children. And especially that verse where he points out that the Jews are contrary to all men, and then you've got the same Paul saying the same in the New Testament. It's quite an enigma that's really just brought up by this Purim festival that the Jews have every year, and they often start wars as well on the date of Purim. I know they've gone and attacked Palestine on that date. And I'm not sure whether they may have. Not sure if they did anything on this February the 28th, but that is a tradition of theirs to go and attack Syria or go and attack Palestine or Lebanon around about this time. So we've been relatively lucky this year, I think, Florian, that they haven't actually done anything. Is there anything else that you'd like to add to that?
No, I think it's pretty comprehensive. I would just say that, a study of the ancient church history is often extremely revealing when you come to these controversies. There's a huge depth that we could go into. Unfortunately, we don't have the time as to how, you know, Martin Luther bamboozled by the Talmudists, by the Pharisees, into accepting their translation of the Hebrew texts instead of defaulting back to the Greek. But anyway, that's a story for another time, perhaps.
Yeah, that's a real shame. I mean, that comes into the the story of why people have gone along with what became the King James version is from listening to these rabbis and putting that one in there instead of putting the Septuagint one in there. Okay, Florian, well, thank you very much for coming on today. I'll be back on Monday with Alison Shablow. And just before we finish, I'll just remind people that she's going to be in court next Wednesday, Westminster Magistrates Court. So if you can be there to support her, please do at 9:30 in the morning. And she'll be with us on Monday. So until then, I hope you all have a great weekend. Thank you very much for listening. God bless and hail victory.